The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. We're starting with a couple of pieces of house news. The first is that we are going to be selling my new book, Shuckland, outside the UK. We're in the process of setting this up on Amazon, but you could also order directly from us here at urbanfantasist.com and pay via PayPal. Sadly, we can't do anything about the extortionate airmail postage charges. We also have an ebook version available on Amazon Kindle. This is in the Kindle print replica format, which is Amazon's equivalent of PDF. And while you can read it on the Kindle app and desktop client versions of Kindle, as well as most Amazon Fire Kindle devices, print replica format is not compatible with all Fire devices. I know, crazy. This is an Amazon issue outside our control, so please do check compatibility first. The second piece of news is that our Weird Tales Show YouTube channel is now starting to roll along, and we should have two new videos up within the next few days. Right, formalities over, now on with the show, and let's introduce this week's guest. It's Dan Hill making a return to this show, this time talking about his new book, Blah Blah Blah, A Snarky Guide to Office Lingo. It's basically a devil's dictionary spin on office jargon, what you think it means and what it actually means in practice. Dan was previously on the show last year talking about his book Famous Faces Decoded, an emotional intelligence primer on how to read politicians and celebrities' true feelings behind their facial expressions. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the show Dan Hill. We were last talking to Dan about his book, Leafs Through, Famous Faces Decoded, which was really all about, well, reading other people's faces and emotions and what they are really saying or not saying. Anyway, Dan now has a new book out called Blah, 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 A Snarky Guide to Office Lingo. It's written by Dan and also by Howard Moskowitz and about 50 other contributors, including me, I hasten to add. So, Dan, good to be speaking to you. Love the book.
Absolutely. Thank you. Happy to be here.
What was your inspiration for writing it? It seems to be a slightly different tack from your other book.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I've always loved humor. I've spoken at many business conferences where eyebrows have shot up when I've said, I'm a Marxist, a Groucho Marxist, because Groucho, of course, famously said to Margaret Dumont, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? And I think we know when it comes to office lingo and things that get said, people, you know, they hint, they hold back, they spin, deflect, all those sorts of things go on. But I've always loved humor. It doesn't matter whether it's Monty Python or anything under the globe, because humor really gives you a chance not to necessarily pummel someone, but to make them realize the absurdity and the inefficiency of how things are getting handled. And hopefully with good humor, you kind of open things up a bit and people can recognize something. As to what inspired the book and your question, I have a podcast called Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, which appears on the New Books Network. And 2 weeks in a row, without my prompting, I had guests who said that they estimated that about 25% of all managers are bullies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just astonished by that in a way, although I can say that 40% of the bosses I had before I started my company were bullies. So maybe it's an undercount of anything. But, you know, both of us know that companies spend a lot of money on reorgs. They spend a lot of money on corporate culture. And yet you've got this cancer sitting right in the middle of the whole shooting match with all these bullying managers. And why don't they get removed? Why don't they get trained better? And I was trying to think about how I could possibly address this because it just seems so outrageous to me. And then I thought of The Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce. He was a contemporary of Mark Twain. The book is considered, his book called The Devil's Dictionary is considered one of the 100 greatest works of American literature. He was actually a journalist and correspondent for William Hearst in the Hearst magazine and newspaper empire. But the book is full of wonderful diabolical definitions like bore, someone who talks when you want them to listen. Yankee, no such thing. See, damn Yankee.
Yeah.
Dentist, someone who puts metal in your mouth while taking gold from your pocket. And I just decided that this would be my approach. And then I said, you know, I'm just one aging white guy. I have no right to speak for everyone else's experiences in the world, regardless of their gender, their race, their age, and which continent they're on. So I wanted to throw it open to a lot of other people. And I did so. And I'm really grateful that you contributed.
Yeah, thank you very much. No, I say it's fascinating, the elements in it. And as someone, I've never worked in a big organization. I've always been a journalist and, you know, usually a freelance. But I've sat through an awful lot of corporate press conferences and presentations. And you just hear the whatever is the latest hype, whatever is the latest buzzword. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the term buzzword bingo, what people are going to say.
Oh, yes, very much
and,
so.
And you know, it's a cliche. And I mean, you do mention Dilbert, the excellent Dilbert cartoons in the start of the book. And I mean, this is, it's that world that, you know, some of the stuff that Dilbert cartoons display, you think, well, this is just nonsensical. But when you've worked in that world, you realize, no, that's how it really goes on. And that most managers are the pointy-headed boss who really doesn't have a clue and is just sort of hanging on for survival and being held there by his underlings who he treats terribly. But if they weren't there, he'd be out of a job. And I say, it's just fascinating, this strange corporate culture that we have.
In honor of Dilbert, if you don't mind, I'm going to mention probably one of my two favorite cartoons of all time. So one is he's down the hallway and there's a big banner that says, "Welcome to marketing, two drinks minimum," which I thought was very funny. And the other one is Dogbert is playing consultant and comes to meet with the boss and says, "I've identified the redundant employees in your organization," and hands him a document. And the boss says, "But this is the company's telephone book." And Dogbert says, "You can't imagine what a time saver that was."
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, and I mean, we've all worked and encountered people, and you think, how have they kept their job? How are they still there? And, you know, they come out in marketing speak and corporate speak and clearly out of their depth, but nobody, you know, I suppose it's the emperor's new clothes. You know, nobody likes to point out that they don't know what they're talking about because it's bad in the hierarchy. And
By the end of my time in corporate life, I only was, one of my job gigs was ever there about 2 years and I survived it. But by the end, I thought that The Emperor's New Clothing was probably the greatest piece of literature ever written because I simply experienced it so often. I had a senior VP that I reported to, and I swear the guy sought like a 12-second opinion for every single thing he did. It was the ultimate in the cliche, you know, analysis paralysis. The guy just couldn't get anything done, but boy, was he pulling down a nice salary.
And it's interesting to see how the fashion for the buzzwords change over time and what they're going to be coming up with. And then suddenly it's been shoehorned into every piece of presentation, every piece of conversation, no matter how irrelevant it may be.
Sure. Well, I was, you know, I have a PhD in English. So once in the time I was in academia, yeah. And I swore that you could always tell when they were a second year, but first semester grad student, because in the first year they had swallowed all the lingo and they were now spouting it. But in truth, by the second semester, the second half of their second year, they had started to get tired of it. You know, the excitement had waned a bit. But boy, in that third semester of their program, they were replete with all the buzzwords that they could now very fluently say. And it was just terrible to have a conversation with them.
In your book, pick some of your favorites from there.
Well, I have to mention first that one of my favorites is indeed yours, and I won't read the whole definition, but it's about the room's minibar, which you call the high water mark of capitalism. And you note that the tiny morsels are so tiny that it's as if they've been gift wrapped by elves. That is simply hilarious and truly one of my favorites. Another one of my favorites, which I think carries a lot of significance actually, is diversity, which I define as in senior management, a short white guy. Because I don't know how it is over in the UK, but in the States, that remains overwhelmingly true. And the statistics just seem glacial in the way that they do not move move forward. I remember when I first came into the workforce, you're talking about the mid-80s, I knew how to type. I didn't know anything else. I remember going out as what we call a temp or a Kelly girl, and I get to an office and all the women and me were in an office, we're in a typing pool in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
And we're working furiously all day long. We get like no breaks other than the bathroom. And around us, all the offices, glass enclosed offices, are guys.
Yeah.
And they're all chatting. Like I swear a third of the day, they're just chatting among themselves while we work really hard. And you're even now you're at a statistic that like, what, 10% of the senior executives are female? I think it's actually about 8% in the Fortune 500 companies. You know, clearly, you know, women have talents. Clearly, they're 51% or more of the population. I just think this is patently absurd because there are all sorts of statistics to show that in terms of profitability and innovation, pace of innovation, the companies that have more diversified senior management, they do better. So if you want to get really cutthroat and say it's forget about justice, Dan, that's woo-woo, that's too soft. and you just say, let's just talk about money. Well, fine, yeah. Let's talk about money. Then let's also talk about gender diversification and race and so forth, because the planet's complex. White people, you and I, we're about 11% of the planet. The number's going down, not up. And if you want customers, you better make sure you understand other people's perspectives. Doesn't mean you always have to have their skin color, but it sure helps if you at least have empathy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I've seen corporate brochures of a company I used to have dealings with. And the front of the corporate brochure was clearly taken from a marketing stock photo. And there was a boardroom and there was a mix of race and gender sitting around and everybody looked healthy. And then they had a photo taken actually on their premises of their own staff at a meeting. And they were all middle-aged white guys and they were all pasty-faced and... You know, overweight, all the things from people who, you know, sales reps who are on the road and eating junk food. And it was sort of wonderful, the comparison between the dream and the actual reality of it.
Sure. Or I remember, because like you, eventually I moved over so that I was a supplier or what's called a vendor sometimes. And that's actually another Dilbert cartoon where the vendor is being forced to crawl on all fours down the conference table because the only person below the lowest employee is the vendor that you can go ahead and abuse. but as a vendor, I must say that one of the wonderful things is you get to leave the building. So you're subjected and you see all of the horrible, stagnant office politics going on. But fortunately, you get to go back into your car and depart the place. But I remember one time I was in Detroit and meeting with General Motors. And he says, do you want to stay for lunch? Well, we head to the lunchroom and it is diversified, but there is not a single table at which people of mixed color are sitting together.
Yeah.
Nowhere in a large lunchroom.
Yeah.
And I went, whoa, I think that's a problem.
Yes. Can't you see it? It's right in front of your eyes. Yes.
Yeah, it's literally black and white. Yeah. So, well, here's another one. Dialogue. Two people discussing a problem in the way the boss wants and that the company would approve of. You know, we need genuine dialogue. We need back and forth. Everybody needs a feedback loop that actually is authentic.
Mm.
And we have terrible blind spots as human beings. One of my wonderful surveys that I came across once was from Europe, and it was 8 countries, and they asked the citizens of each country in turn, which country in Europe is the most arrogant, is the least arrogant, and which one is the most compassionate? And with only 2 exceptions, they always, in self-aggrandizement fashion, chose their own country. The only 2 exceptions was that the Italians said the Spanish were actually less arrogant. And in the case of the Czech Republic, they said the Slovaks were. But in every other case, lo and behold, no, we're the most wonderful. We're the most wonderful. And, you know, left to our own devices, that's what human beings will do.
Yeah. Sadly.
I talk about customer service? This would be another one.
Oh, customer service. We love customer service.
Yes. Yeah, we always talk about how important it is, customer service. And so I came up with this one. Your call is very important to us. That's the term.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition is, and now here in full, while you wait, is Beethoven's 9th Symphony. Because your call is not very important to us. It is a cost as opposed to a revenue stream.
Yeah,
and we will fund and staff as poorly as we possibly can get away with.
Oh yes,
I always thought that if the CEO or the CEO's wife or somebody actually called into the corporate switchboard and realized the person had wandered off and no one was answering, or you know how the telephone tree worked, and you know hit this number, then hit this number, then go to this number.
Yeah,
they go crazy. They go they go bonkers. And yet they tolerate it because I don't want to spend the money.
Yeah. No, it's a particularly galling thing where they say your call is important to us. And I find myself pointlessly shouting down the phone. Yeah, but not that important. You're going to staff your support service with enough people to answer your customers.
Yeah. Yes. Or here's another one. Untouchable. In India, a member of the lowest caste. In corporate life, the exact opposite.
Beautiful. Oh, that is priceless. I love that.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
To your point earlier, I mean, how are these people in charge? Mm. I mean, some of them are very good. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's some really brilliant people, but they can be hard edge brilliant, like you're around the mafia. I remember being on a British Airlines flight, and they had a survey of British business executives. What's your favorite movie of all time? And like 80% of them chose The Godfather, which I really love as a movie. But I said, what does this say about your ethos and how you deal with your rivals and your customers and everything else under the sun? There's just so often very little accountability. Those people are seemingly untouchable.
And at the moment, getting richer, a lot of them.
Yes, phenomenally richer. It's appalling. I admit I create a slight distinction. If you actually created the business, it was your idea, you made all the sacrifices. Bill Gates suffers from a good deal of contempt on his face, as I know as an expert. And obviously now his marriage, dissolved based on some of his behavior. But at least Bill worked hard and is a bright fellow. And I remember relating to him because he said, I think in the third year, he said, I took off Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Because for years in running my company, my wife would take photographs. This is Dan at Thanksgiving. This is Dan on New Year's Day. This is Dan on this day. And I was always working.
Yeah.
Because I had a small company. And if I didn't work, things weren't going to move forward.
Yeah.
But the executives who are caretakers, who did not create the business, who did not sacrifice, but now they're in charge. They survived. They got promoted despite incompetency.
Yeah.
And they had these enormous paychecks.
Yep.
Just enormous paychecks. It's unfair.
Yeah.
I'm trying to look for it. I think I had something about quality control. And I said it was something like checking the thread count on the executive's golden parachutes.
Oh, I love that. Yes.
Or here's one. Burn the boats, says the CEO while watching from a distant yacht.
Yes.
Because I think if you're really a leader, of course, you have to bring people by definition with you. There has to be followers, but even better is colleagues or a sense that you are in this together. Many years ago, I wrote a book on American festivals, and one of them was the Afro-Caribbean festival in Brooklyn. And it was fascinating because they had corporate sponsors who were placed at the head of the parade, but there were no followers. Because what happened was they started the parade at the first float with, you know, American Airlines, et cetera, started moving down the street, and everyone just waited until there was like at least a half mile distance. And then the second float started partying. The music started, people started jumping on board, jumping off and mingling with the crowd, completely different flavor from the snuff shirts who were now a half a mile or more, you know, disconnected from the rest of the partygoers. Yeah. And I looked at it that day and went, huh, that's a lot like corporate life, actually. I've got the people in the corner offices and they have very little sense of what else is going on. And the idea that we're in this together pretty much doesn't exist.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah, sadly, actually. I'm saying this with some glee only in that I remember the festival was a lot of fun. But the daily reality of corporate life, you know, often is not much fun at all.
Yeah. What do you have in the book? Give us some examples on meetings, because I mean, meetings are always a fascinating feature and people are always holding forth on things like LinkedIn on how to make cut down on meetings or make meetings more useful.
Yeah,
when it comes to it, the meetings seem very often to be called by a senior exec who wants everybody there to listen to his latest pontifications and really is not interested in any feedback or anything.
Oh, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's quite a few, of course. One of them is an all-day meeting, which is particularly tedious, obviously.
Yeah.
And the answer is a badly facilitated one-hour discussion.
Lovely.
And it's true to your point, because think about the efficiency we demand on the factory floor. At one point in high school, I worked at a factory that my father had previously managed, actually. And there was all these quotas and you had to get this done and that done. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. There was a lot of accountability. And then you think about a meeting. There are too many people in the meeting. Mm-hmm. Nothing changes as a result of a meeting. As a friend of mine said, a meeting's like a story. But in this case, it has a beginning, a really long middle part, no climax. And it's not so much a denouement as it's simply you run out of time and you move on to the next equally boring meeting.
Yeah.
And that tends to be what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right on that. You know, I think meetings have probably got even worse now because people are on their phones.
Yes.
Throughout.
Yes. Yeah. If you've had the occasion, as I had, to be a speaker on the podium at a conference, you are at the same time noticing that there are quite a few people on their phones or their laptops and, you know, you're fighting for their attention because there are all sorts of distractions and other opportunities.
Yeah.
Another definition in the book is staff meetings, tedium interspersed with boredom. You know, it's sort of what someone said of Katharine Hepburn, who's actually a great actor, but I think it was Dorothy Parker who said, oh yes, Katharine Hepburn runs the entire emotional gambit from A to B and back again.
Yes.
Too many meetings are actually like that.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have anything in the book about everyone's pet favorite or hate, I mean, PowerPoint?
Yeah, I do have one on PowerPoint. I can't probably find it immediately, but I think it's something like statistics and graphic symbols fighting to avoid asphyxiation. and I say that because one time, speaking of conferences in North Carolina, I followed to the stage someone from Walmart. And boy, were people happy to have me there, because that person's charts, every slide was chock full of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a joke to be heard in the guy's presentation. There was no imagery whatsoever. There were no call out quotes. There was basically no fun. There was nothing in it for the audience, just this long slog of numbers. And if that was any indication of what Walmart's culture is like, heaven help us all.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think that's a good spot to end it on. It really does sum it up. And I say, the book is called Blah, 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 A Snarky Guide to Office Lingo. And it's available on Amazon. How's it going? Because it's now been out, what, about a month or so, is it?
Somewhere in that range. It's in the top 30, I believe, for business humor, which is almost an oxymoron, I suppose. I'll win whatever category I have a chance in, and that's fine. So I'm happy. You know, there's 80,000 business books out at any given time on Amazon.
Yeah.
So God knows there's a lot of competition.
Yeah.
So if you can move up the ranks, it's a pretty sweet thing.
Yeah. And what are you planning next? Because, I mean, you've written other books, and like most authors, once you've got a book out, you inevitably are thinking of other ideas and things. So what have you got next on your agenda?
It's funny you should ask that question. I had told my wife after this book, I said, shoot me. Categorically shoot me if I write another book. And what am I doing? I'm involved in a book project. I'm not writing exactly. So here's the twist. So probably my most famous book is Emotionomics by Kogan Page. They're in the UK, mm-hmm. Including a nice foreword back in the day by Sam Simon, the co-creator of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And Kogan Page wanted me to come out with the 10th anniversary edition in 2017, and I demurred. But with all the things going on, you know, Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, even the Business Roundtable came out and said, actually, we need to move off shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism. Basically, they're admitting they need to be more humane.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recently said, here's my moment. I really should come out with not the 10th, but the 15th anniversary.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do it as a written book because I don't want my wife to assassinate me because I already gave her the instructions. So I'm going to record it with two guys who are going to interview me, basically. It's going to be a voiced book. I think it's just much more fun to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember my very first book back in the day was with John Wiley and Sons, and a friend of mine said,
yeah.
Reading the book, he said, well, the editor must have gotten tired because about the 7th chapter, your voice comes back in the book. they had basically killed off my voice. And the great thing about doing it in this fashion is my voice will definitely be there for all of its better for worse, all of its blemishes. My character will be on display, and hopefully some humor and some wit, and most importantly, some warmth.
Yeah,
I think we both know a lot of business books are just about as dry as could be.
Mm-hmm.
And they make me think of a line from Milan Kundera, the Czech writer, who said, don't trust anyone without a sense of humor. I never met a KGB agent who had one.
Yes. Ah, that's wonderful. Well, Dan, thank you ever so much for your time. We'll be including the links to where people can find your book on the show's information. And good luck with the new book. And there's no truth in the rumor that your wife is currently down at the local gun shop checking out checking out Magnums.
Well, thank you for that. Along with the room's mini bar being the high mark of capitalism, I am trying in some small way to make blah, blah, blah a second high mark of capitalism, but on the basis of urging reform instead.
Yeah. Lovely. Okay, Dan, until the next time we meet, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Dan Hill. You can find him online at www.sensorylogic.com and on Amazon. As ever, there'll be links on the urbanfantasies.com website, as well as in the podcast and YouTube metadata. I've been going over to Yarmouth on a more frequent basis, and in my spare time having a chance to poke around the town and see what I can find. And now, one of the things that intrigued me was the name of one of the little streets there. It's called the Kitty Witches Row, which is spelt as in witchcraft witches. Now, with the rows, let's just put the background in there. When Yarmouth first developed in the Middle Ages, it was essentially on a sandspit between the mouth of the River Yar, where its name comes from, and the North Sea. There were city walls around it, but it essentially meant it was a very long, narrow town with lots of narrow streets running parallel to each other across the sandbar. These streets were called rows, and there were 145 of them. In fact, many of them were only given the number. So you lived in number 44 row or number 122 row. And when I say narrow, they were, in some instances, just 27 inches wide in parts. Charles Dickens, who wrote David Copperfield, which is based in Yarmouth and knew the area, described them saying, "A row is a long, narrow lane or alley, quite straight or nearly as may be, with houses on each side, both of which you can sometimes touch at once with the fingertips of each hand by stretching out your arms to the full extent." And I'd say these streets remained, or rows remained, pretty much the same for the best part of 600 years until the 19th century, when the town started to expand in other areas and were no longer restricted to it. But why is this particular row called the Kitty Witches Row? Now, one suggestion is that Kitty Witches was a local name for the swimming crabs that were found in the nearby Braden Water. This is the large, almost like a lake, at the mouth of the River Yar on one side of Yarmouth. And the idea being that the rows were so narrow, it was easier to enter them sideways like a crab. Nice idea. Another suggestion is that there was a flying beetle called the cockchafer, which was known in this part of Norfolk as a kitty witch. There's also a suggestion it related to a type of seabird, that there was a female spectre dressed in white that used to haunt it, and that it was derived from the Dutch word kittywidge, meaning house of bad repute. And why would the Dutch be saying that? Well, Great Yarmouth is just across the North Sea from Holland, and it used to, in medieval times and until much later, used to have an annual herring fair which ran from Michaelmas, September the 29th, through to Martinmas, November the 11th. And large numbers of Dutchmen would come over and frequent the houses of bad repute. There's another story here by the Reverend Robert Forby, and writing some years before his death in 1830, he said it was home to the Kitty Witches, who were women of ill repute who would terrorise residents in order to fund their drinking sessions. He wrote that a Kitty Witch was a woman dressed in a grotesque and frightful manner, otherwise called a kitty witch, probably for the sake of a jingle. I don't get that, but I must admit. It was customary many years ago for Yarmouth women of the lowest order to go in troops from house to house to demand contributions at some season of the year to support their drinking. And they would wear men's shirts over their own clothing, and their faces would be smeared with mud and blood. And the Reverend Forby goes on to say, "These hideous beldams have long discontinued their perambulations, but in memory of them, one of the many rows in that town was called Kittywitch Row." Another far less exciting explanation is the row was named after a former resident who was a baker there. His name was Christopher Witch, spelt W-Y-C-H-E, so pronounced Witch. And Christopher, as you probably know, is frequently shortened to Kit. So Kit Witch's Row, Kitty Witch Row. Oh dear. No witches on broomsticks then. Shame.
Hey guys, news. The title is Shuckland, and it's a brand new book by Charles Christian. It takes you on a journey through the weird wonders and intriguing mysteries of the Waveney Valley. Explore with Charles the truth behind the notorious black shuck of the book's title. Be transported to a world of demonic entities, murderous earls, ley lines, witchcraft, paganism, and discover the facts behind the outrageous legends and folklore of this seemingly peaceful corner of England. Shuckland is a 200-page illustrated paperback available through bookshops and online via Amazon and Books Etc., as well as the Urban Fantasist website at www.urbanfantasist.com. Shuckland is priced at $12.95, and there's an ebook version available on Amazon priced just £3.25. Shuckland, get yours today.
We always start the Weird Tales radio show with the voiceover saying the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. But what's the story behind that? Well, Misery Corner is in South Norfolk, in the village of Denton, which, as we say, is about a quarter of a mile from where we make these shows. And it's on the corner of the Darrow Green Road and Manor Farm Road. There's no signpost to mark its name, but it does appear on Ordnance Survey maps. So what's its origin? One suggestion is it takes its name from being one of the last places anyone being dragged off for execution at the nearby Hangman's Hill, a site is next to Denton Castle, would see in their life, and they would clearly be very miserable about that. Another theory is it's linked to a young servant girl who worked at one of the big houses on the corner and committed suicide there, either after she fell pregnant and or saw her lover being taken off to be hanged. It's said she jumped into one of the deep ponds around there and drowned herself. But what's the truth? If you visit Denton Castle, originally a Norman-era Moton Bailey castle, it was only ever a timber fort on a small mound surrounded by an enclosure and a ditch, and in later years became used mainly as a hunting lodge for the deer park that was there in the medieval era. In fact, if you visit the site now, you can still see quite clearly there is parkland around it. But whatever else it was, Denton Castle was not a place where the Norman barons cruelly oppressed and hanged their Saxon serfs. Which just brings us to Hangman's Hill. This is a small tree-covered mound to the east of the castle, reputedly the location of a gallows and the site for executions. There's even the stump of a tree on the top of the mound, which could be mistaken for the base of a gibbet. Sadly, there is no historical nor archaeological evidence to indicate executions ever took place there. The more likely explanation is the mound is spoiled from the digging of an adjacent pond to provide water for cattle, which was then given the more melodramatic name of Hangman's Hill during the 19th century. The Victorians, it should be noted, were great ones for manufacturing traditions and legends. Indeed, it's noticeable that the name Hangman's Hill does not appear on the 1838 Ordnance Survey map of the area, suggesting its name is relatively recent. But if no executions ever took place at Hangman's Hill, that destroys one of the explanations for the origin of the name Misery Corner. However, there is another possibility, but for that we first need to visit the neighbouring town of Harleston. Heading out of Harleston on the Redenhall Road, just past the sewage works and the turning for the curiously named Hall Wong Lane, pull into the entrance of the drive of the Broken Egg Farm Cafe. With the statue of the giant chicken on your right, the Waveney Valley has a thing about chicken statues, look across the road to the fields to the north of you. You'll see this area marked on maps as lush bush, definitely not nut bush. The name is derived from a hawthorn tree that as long ago as 1668 was known as a lush's bush. According to local legend, the bush is supposed to have germinated and sprung from the wooden stake that was hammered through the heart of a murderer and suicide called Lush, who was buried in this location. No, the late Mr. Lush was not a vampire. Instead, his fate stems from the common practice of burying suicides. Suicides were classed as self-murderers on unconsecrated ground, preferably at a crossroads on the outskirts of a town, and then staked through the heart, ideally with hawthorn or willow, to prevent their unhappy spirits from ever troubling the living. According to the English author, clergyman, occultist, and all-round eccentric Montague Summers, I can say that safely because he died in 1948, when the ghost of a body issues forth from the grave and finds there are four paths stretching in as many directions, it will be puzzled to know which way to take and will be still be standing there debating until dawn compels it to return to the earth. On a more practical explanation, crossroads frequently marked the outer boundaries of settlements and so were a convenient location for the disposal of unwelcome corpses. It may sound primitive, but the practice of what was termed profane burials continued for many years, with the last such burial at Lushbush being recorded as recently as April 1813. According to the report that subsequently appeared in the Norfolk Chronicle, a woman called Mary Turrell had apparently poisoned herself after being accused of killing her newly born daughter, whose body was found in a nearby pond at Harleston. Today, Turrell's infanticide would probably be attributed to postnatal depression, but such enlightened views did not exist 200 years ago. Instead, the inquest on Turrell recorded a verdict of felo de se, self-murder, and according to a local newspaper report, on the same evening about 7 o'clock, she was buried in the high road with a stake driven through her body in the presence of a vast concourse of people. The exact location of this burial is lost as the layout of the area was dramatically changed by the construction of the now also long vanished Waveney Valley Railway line in the mid-19th century. The same goes for the original lush bush, which was chopped down a long time ago, although it's said the man who felled it subsequently went quite mad. The felling also apparently released the spirit of Lush, whose ghost is reported to still haunt the area. So what has poor Mary Turrell's death got to do with Misery Corner? The connection is Misery Corner is a road junction on what would have been the edge of a village. In other words, another place where suicides would suffer the miserable fate of a profane burial and being buried with a stake through their hearts. As we make our way along the gloomy venue of overhanging trees from Misery Corner at twilight, you can understand why some local people are reluctant to walk along it alone at night. They believe it is haunted by the ghost of the servant girl who killed herself. Some even say they have felt cold, wet fingers gripping at their hands as they walked along here. Just their imagination, or is it? Now we're going on safari again to search for another of my fabulous creatures. This is part of the series I run with the Ancient Origins magazine. And the topic of this latest one is the vegetable lamb of Tartary. And yes, you didn't mishear me. I did say vegetable lamb. As I've said many times before in this series, no matter how fantastical some of the fabulous creatures may seem, if you scratch deep beneath the surface of a legend, you'll find a nugget of truth, albeit a nugget of truth that has been distorted by time, misunderstanding, and ignorance. No more is this so than the case of the Barametz, or vegetable lamb of Tartary, which, as the name implies, was once believed to be a species of plant that grew sheep as its fruit. Technically, this would have been a zoophyte, a now discredited concept of an organism that is part animal and part lamb. But the vegetable lamb was originally chronicled in the 14th century, and the concept of the zoophyte was not finally discredited until the early 19th century. So we cannot criticise the science of the first people who described the Barametz or vegetable lambs. So where did the legend of Sthing, this also known as the Scythian lamb, begin? The first full report occurs in the Travels of Sir John Mandeville, a travel memoir that appeared between the years 1357 and 1371, and which purport to be the journal of an English knight from the town of St. Albans. Except Sir John never existed. Instead, the more likely candidate for the author is a 14th century Liège, now in Belgium, physician called Jehan de Bourgoigne, who compiled the travels from extracts stolen from other authors' works, including a certain Friar Oderic of Pordenone, interwoven with complete flights of fancy. There is also no evidence Jehan de Bourgoigne ever visited Tartary, a term used to describe what we'd now call Central Asia. This is unlike Friar Oderic, who he pinched the story from, who travelled extensively throughout Central Asia, India and China. But what about the vegetable lamb? This, with the some misunderstanding of Chinese legends by Friar Oderic, actually seems to be based on a lack of knowledge of textiles by medieval Europeans. The most widely worn clothing material was wool, which comes from sheep. So when the first cotton garments began to appear in Western Europe, coming from Egypt, India and other exotic locations within what we then called Tartary, it was assumed they must come from some kind of special type of lamb. At the same time, there were also first reports of cotton plants and of cotton bowls being seen in the wild. Somewhere along the way, the two ideas became intermingled and combined, giving birth to belief that the fluffy cotton bowls were a type of baby sheep that lived on a plant, hence the vegetable lamb. In fact, it was even posited the way the lamb derived nutrients was that the stalk of the plant could flex downwards, allowing the lamb to feed on the grass and plants surrounding it. The lamb's flesh, incidentally, was said to taste of honey. It all sounds laughable now, but it was not until the late 17th century, nearly 350 years after the Travels of Sir John Mandeville were first published, that the fabled vegetable lamb of Tartary was recognised to be just that, a fable. Here's a wonderful tale from the website Atlas Obscura of obscure places to visit. And it's Tombstone House in Petersburg, Virginia. To be exact, it's 1736 Young's Road, Petersburg, Virginia. This is an example of waste not, want not, or perhaps better, waste not, haunt not. It's a stone house, but it has very macabre origins. It was constructed in 1935 from the bottom half of government-issued marble tombstones that previously topped the graves of Union soldiers in the Poplar Lawn Cemetery. Yeah, you heard that. So basically, the soldiers all died in the Siege of Petersburg, which lasted for 9 months at the end of the American Civil War. Civil War, as you call it in America. And they were eventually buried at the Poplar Lawn Cemetery. And after their original wooden grave markers had rotted away, the government installed upright marble headstones to take their place. However, during the Great Depression, which is now, 90 years ago, maintaining the cemetery and the headstones suffered because there was not enough money to go around. The city decided to cut its costs by cutting the tombstones in half and lay the top halves, which were engraved with the soldiers' details, on the ground, so they no longer stood upright. These flat graves save money on mowing and maintenance costs. But what to do with the bottom halves of the tombstones? There were 2,200 of them. They were sold for the princely sum of $45, and their new owner, Oswald Young, used them to build his house, chimney and walkway. When you look at the house, you can quite clearly see it might look like they're breeze block slabs, but no, they are marble tombstone bottoms. Yes. Insert your own puns here. Must be nice and ghoul in summer, but probably not the most inviting door to knock on during Halloween. Anyway, you can find it by accessing the Squirrel Level Road exit 65 of 185. Go north on Squirrel Level through the traffic lights. Squirrel Level then becomes Young's Road, and Tombstone House is the third house on the left. Not even half a mile off the interstate. Yes, add that to your road trip around America. We haven't had any magic for a while, so let's remedy that with a couple of spells and rituals. The first one, called Burying in the Past, and this is recommended in Everyday Magic, a pagan book of days, and it suggested it's an appropriate one to practice in mid-October. And what you do is find a dead leaf, plenty of them at this time of the year, write on it, ideally in non-toxic ink, marker pen, write on it something you wish to be rid of, such as a bad habit or an addiction, or even a person that you want out of your life. This is what you write. Goodbye, whatever. Cigarettes. You were part of my life, but now you are dead to me. I consign you to the earth. May you rot there. Let there be fertile ground for better things to grow in the fullness of time. And that's it. And then go inside and have a warm drink or an alcoholic beverage. The second one I've got from Llewellyn's Book of Days. And this is, again, recommended for mid-October and is particularly pertinent given that we had the famous six-hour Facebook outage last week when a lot of people said, wow, wasn't that nice? And it's to have a media-free day. Dion Fortune once wrote that if magic is the art of causing changes in consciousness in conformity with will, then we can make magnificent changes by exercising choice. So we're going to use this to augment the power of our will and make change. So today, or whatever day you want to do it on, choose to limit your media exposure. Try it for just one day. Be mindful of what information you consume. Avoid junk food messages and fear-mongering. Leave the radio off. Turn the television off, bypass the newspaper stand or e-news, and avoid looking at internet news feeds and particularly Facebook. Do this for just one day. Then, after the day, on the evening, evaluate your energy. Do you feel less anxiety, fear, and dread? If you do, contemplate extending your choice, cutting down your daily consumption of media. Perhaps then you'll realise that the world isn't quite as scary a place as some newspapers, television channels, and broadcasters and social media would have you believe. Almost time to go, but before we do, we've had a question, a grim question at that, in from one of our listeners relating to a story we ran earlier this year about gibbet and gallows sites in England. Is it true, he asks, that in olden times people were hanged in chains while they were still alive and then left to slowly die on a gibbet from starvation, dehydration and exposure? It's a common belief, and there are plenty of folk tales of people passing by dying wretches in their cages. For example, in the case of the Caxton Gibbet in Cambridgeshire, there is a story that a baker, passing by on his travels, took pity on the condemned man and threw him a bread bun to eat, only to be arrested for his charity and end his life hanging in chains next to the man he'd tried to save. This did not happen. The misconception stems from the similarity of the terms being hanged, with rope around your neck, and hanging in chains. All the people who were gibbeted during relatively recent times, and by that I mean from the mid-16th century to 1832 when the practice was abolished, were already dead when they were hanged in chains or in a cage. However, this was not always the case, and in earlier, more barbarous medieval times, people were undoubtedly gibbeted alive. Incidentally, a replica of the Caxton gibbet now stands in the car park of a McDonald's takeaway. Make of that what you will. And on that doubly macabre note, it just remains for me to say this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more weird tales in weird times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist at icloud.com, and on Twitter at urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.